Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader, brought to you by Wellington Square Bookshop. Our guest today is Philip Goff, author of Why, The Purpose of the Universe. It was published last week, November 9th, by the Oxford University Press. And the last time we spoke to Philip, I know, was in 2020 after the release of Galileo's Error. It's interesting, that was Foundations for a New Science of Consciousness. And it's interesting how the two concepts, that of self-awareness and purpose, kind of intersect, if that's the right word. You know, what is the universe? Does it care about us? Where is it going? And are we going with it? So scientists don't necessarily believe in a predetermined purpose at all. And then religious belief is simple and comforting. I wish I had faith, as Philip actually did at one point. You know, a loving God creating the whole thing, and without him not, you know, I would love to have that, because it makes it so much easier to live. It's like having your own personal valet of sorts. And then philosophers either agree with Philip or they don't. And there's a lot who don't. There's some who do. You know, is generally philosophers are saying, you know, is this subjective or is there a teleological direction? Kind of like the arrow of time. And then existentialists, nihilists believe in the indifference of the universe. The closing sentences of nausea come to mind, as they oft times do with me. And I believe in something completely different. And am I of a moment or of no moment at all? So in any event, here to shed light on, but perforce unable to answer his own question, is Philip. Welcome, Philip. Thanks for coming back.
Hi, good to speak to you again, Sam. Wow, what an incredible, intriguing introduction. I'm looking forward to what follows.
Well, I was talking to you before we started about listening to everybody should listen to this, because they're both smarter than me. The Closer to the Truth chat, which is a great podcast. And that was just a couple of days ago. And I listened to it carefully because Philip was able to articulate his thesis, if that is what it is, so well that it was like, you know, I had already read the book, but it was like, okay, here's the book again. It was really done well. So to begin with, let me ask you, as I said before, we started again. Well, because I'm not as smart as you guys, I think it's a good way to start, because asking dumb questions sometimes gets really good answers. So I'll ask you the same question I asked you last time around, which is, what if it is just solipsistic, which I kind of fervently believe, and which you can't disprove?
Wow, that is a very unexpected and excellent first question. And by the way, I mean, nobody knows what we're talking about on this stuff, so I think your guess is as good as anyone's. Solipsism, well, if we're meaning the same thing by that, that's the view that I am the only person that actually exists, which is, it's a very difficult concept to disprove. I think René Descartes was right that the only thing I know for certain is the existence of my own conscious mind, right here, right now. He famously said, I think, therefore I am, cogito ergo sum. But beyond that, or even in the past and future, a moment ago or a moment hence, all of our experience of reality is indirect, right? I don't know if there really is a table out here in front of me corresponding to my conscious experience, or maybe I'm just in the matrix. Maybe it's all a dream. Maybe it's just me. And that does, in a way, seem to be the simplest hypothesis. If the only thing I have direct acquaintance with is my own conscious mind, maybe that's the only thing I'm entitled to believe in. But I suppose I think it's rationally acceptable, even if only for pragmatic reasons, to trust that the world is as our experience tells us it is. Actually, well, I've got a little analogy in the book. I think life is a little bit like, you wake up down the bottom of a deep hole with amnesia, and you don't know how you got here, right? You know, you just absolutely no idea. But there's a voice outside you can hear speaking to you, and it's telling you how you got here, what happened, what you need to do to get out. Now, in a sense, you've got no idea whether you can trust that voice. You've got amnesia. It could be anyone. It could be someone trying to trick you. But it's all you've got to go on. And so I think in that sense, it's rational to take that leap of faith and trust that voice that is trying to, that is to trust that it's telling you the truth. So I think life's a bit like that. We're all, each of us is stuck in our own, as you say, solipsistic conscious mind, but our experience purports to tell us about a world around us and about other people. And I think in the absence of anything better to go on, it's rational to take that leap of faith and trust those experiences and live the life we seem to be living. You know, Descartes wanted to get around this by proving the existence of God and then proving that God wouldn't deceive us so we can trust our experiences. Don't think that argument entirely worked out. But I think, you know, you got to live your life. Maybe it's hope rather than belief, but it's, I think it's okay to trust, take that leap of faith and trust what your senses seem to be telling you and see how things go.
Yeah, and the thing is I've always thought, well, if I'm right, and only one of us is here, and one of us is one of your posited zombies, would I do anything differently than I do now? No, because I'll do exactly the same thing. And your analogy reminds me of my viewpoint of how things work, which is that for all of eternity, we're swimming in this deep, warm, blue ocean. And then we pop up for a moment, look around, see a tree, see an airplane, and then go back down and just keep swimming. That seems logical to me because we don't get that much. There isn't that much here. There should be a lot more.
Yeah, but that's another beautiful metaphor. And yeah, I mean, solipsism, you can't really live it out, can you? It's like, okay, you believe in solipsism. Why are you telling me about it? You don't think I exist.
Well, it's fun. I'm still allowed to have fun, even if it's
That's true. Yeah, it's like playing a video game or something. I mean, it's an old joke about solipsism. I hope it's not true, but if it is true, I hope it doesn't catch on. But
that leads directly into why you should be religious. And you were at one time. You can talk about that because it's like Pascal's wager. You may as well believe in God and an afterlife because you got nothing to lose.
Yeah. And another person I was going to mention there was William James, the great 19th century scientist and philosopher, psychologist and philosopher, who argued that he had a paper called The Will to Believe. But he later said he wished he'd called it The Right to Believe, which I think would be a better title. And he argues that to some extent, it can be rational to hope beyond the evidence. You know, so if you've got like a loved one who's very ill and the diagnosis is not great, maybe they've got a 30% chance of pulling through. Okay, you don't know they're going to pull through, but it can be rational to sort of hope, to say, I've got faith, you're going to make it, I'm going to believe in you. Now, you know, to a limited extent, you know, if there's like a 1% chance, maybe it would be foolish to hope. Maybe then you should try and reconcile the both of you to what's the inevitability of death. But it can be rational to an extent, especially when there's so much uncertainty in life. So yeah, so I do think religious faith could perhaps in certain contexts be rational if the evidence, what one of James's criteria was, that the evidence has to be 50-50, not weighing heavily in either direction. As another philosopher, John Hick, put it, the universe has to be religiously ambiguous. You know, some things point to God, some things point against God. So, but actually what I, yeah, so I, well, you said I was religious when I was raised Catholic, but I decided when I was 14, I didn't believe in God, refused to get confirmed, upset my grandmother very much. But I guess the one philosophical argument. I've changed my mind on lots of things. The one philosophical argument that stayed with me is the familiar difficulty of reconciling a loving, all-powerful God with the terrible suffering we find in the universe. You know, why would a God choose to create us through such a horrific, long-winded process like natural selection? Why would a loving God create the North American long-tailed shrew, which paralyzes its prey and then slowly eats it alive over several days before it dies from its wounds? You know, that makes no sense to me. Why would a loving God create these horrific things we find in the world? So I don't think it's sort of 50-50 with God, at least the traditional God of the all-knowing, all-powerful, perfectly good creator of the universe, what philosophers call the omni-God, omnipotent, omniscient, omnibenevolent, because I think that's so hard to reconcile with the horrific suffering we find in the universe. So I don't believe in a God of traditional Western religion. However, and this is the point of the book, I guess, I also think there's things the traditional atheist view can't explain. So I you know, most people think, oh, you have to fit into this binary. Either you're Richard Dawkins atheist, or you're, you know, believe in the God of traditional religion. You know, is it, whose side are you on, Richard Dawkins or the Pope? And I've eventually come to think actually both of these views have things they can't explain about reality, and we need to explore the much neglected middle ground between those options, which is really what this book's all about.
Yeah, and it's very pertinent because, well, there are so many things that were relevant to what's happening today. Look at what's happening today, and it doesn't jibe with the existence of God. I mean, just what's happening in Israel, what's happening in the Ukraine. It doesn't make any sense that babies haven't even had a chance to exist or to experience what we're talking about. But be that as it may, I wanted to switch to one thing because really intrigued me, and you have it there, which is the cover of your book, because it kind of looks, first it looks really pleasant, and then it looks like my grandson's bedroom, and it's like you talk about complication and the universe tending towards the complicated and entropy. Why did you choose to create this cover, which will sell as a bookseller? This will help sell the book because it's a great cover. Why did you choose to show that lovely library and that home tending towards disorder?
That's a great question. It is a beautiful cover, isn't it? Well, there's a bit of a story about this, actually. It was a bit of a team effort. I think that the publisher initially suggested Aztec ruins because I think they didn't want it to be too cliched, a book about the purpose of the universe. I suppose you might put stars or a face appearing in stars. I mean, they didn't want it to be too cliched. They wanted to sort of stand out from that. And then my wife, inspired by that, found this series of images you can get online about by a particular photographer, hopefully credits them in the book. Nature overpowering old buildings. And it's such a wonderful idea of the unstoppability of nature ultimately winning, overcoming human efforts in the end, I suppose, with a kind of purpose. So that's what the book is about. It's not just about, it's saying purpose and goal directedness doesn't come just from human beings, contrary to your standard Richard Dawkins atheist type point of view, that purpose and meaning just come from human beings. So I don't defend the traditional religious picture, but I do think there's a case to be made that the universe has a kind of purpose or goal directedness. So I suppose that this idea of the purpose in nature ultimately overcoming human purpose, or perhaps enveloping human purpose might be a better word. I don't want to think like we're in conflict. It's in conflict with humanity. So my wife saw those images, and then I chose this one, and then the design team for the publisher just did a great job there. I actually discovered a couple of people tweeted at me that there's an album cover. I can't remember the band now who've chosen the same image.
Well, you have the band, so you can just use it for your next.
I do have a band. Well, in principle, but everyone's got babies and in different parts of the country now. So we haven't played for about a million years, but
Well, it's funny because, you know, and I know your political beliefs are, you know, somewhat unusual. We can maybe, because, and you put some of them in the end of the book, which was, I went, what?
Yeah, my last book.
About taxation.
I tried to put politics in the last book, and the editor said, look, this has got nothing to do with panpsychism. We're taking it out. And this time, well, I suppose the fight. So most of the book is just this cold-blooded scientific and philosophical argument for what I call cosmic purpose, that there is some sort of purpose or goal directedness in the universe. And most of the book is just arguing for that. And you could, my colleague David Ferracci, when I talked about this stuff, said, yeah, I can see the case for cosmic purpose, but I don't care about it. Nothing to do with me. You know, I make my own purpose. And, you know, most, you could read most of the book and have that attitude. It just, I suppose, the first chapter and the last chapter, I explore the implications for human meaning and purpose. And I think about spiritual practice and community and politics. And so I brought in the politics there. And I think that the editor was a little bit unsure about this. And why we added the postscript on taxation, because I was bringing in some political views here, and he said, it's too thin what you've said. It's like, it's just like you're talking in a pub or something. We need, you know. And so I said, well, what if I've got this essay on certain political views that I'd printed elsewhere. You know, what if we just reprint that as a postscript?
Well,
PS,
so, I mean,
so that it fills it out a bit more, the substance. But I appreciate, it's a very varied book, Sam.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's the thing, is we could even go places that we're not going to go, like Bono. We'll stay away from Bono. You could have stuck Bono in the book, for God's sake.
Oh, yeah. Well, I made headlines for, well, we're going to leave it there. Yeah.
We're trying to sell the book. And that is not, doesn't, your balloon does not go towards the purpose of the universe.
Oh, you've done your homework. Don't Google me and Bono. Just read the book.
But going to the political, it's like, what really makes me laugh is the self-righteousness of people wanting to save the planet and save the earth, because the earth is fine. That tree will come through the ruins of what we've created. If we increase the temperature of the oceans by 4 degrees, Fahrenheit. Oh, yeah, what will happen will happen. But the Earth has recovered from 5 and now perhaps 6 apocalyptic events. And the Earth is fine. It's us who we have to worry about if we're important enough to worry about.
Maybe some other species as well.
Yeah, it's always 99% get wiped out, you know. The shrew. That shrew will probably survive.
But it'll just be the shrew, the only one left.
The shrew alone. There's a title for your album. Well, the other thing is, I thought, okay, everybody I interview now, there's a subtitle with you guys. But what if it was just called Why? I mean, because every morning I wake up going, what is this? And why is it? And
Because
it's a big why. It's the biggest why there is.
Yeah, that would have been more nicely ambiguous and intriguing, wouldn't it? I originally wanted to call it The Purpose of Existence, just the title. And I suppose I think I was going to call it The Purpose of Existence Between God and Atheism. And then I thought they thought that was a bit too big.
That wouldn't have worked.
But I suppose, I did want to get across the central idea that this is, because why is maybe a little bit, it would have been fun that, I suppose, but maybe a little bit too ambiguous. I think there are quite a few books called Why, actually. You're not allowed to copyright book titles. So I think adding The Purpose of the Universe really dramatizes the central idea and what it's all about.
And also, you don't want to get too close to Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy either.
Right. 42 being the answer.
Yeah. So the other way this is going to take a minute, but this is who I've interviewed in the past couple of years. This will take no more than a minute. So yeah, obviously the Crown Prince, who's behind you, David Chalmers, Reality Plus, and then Lectures in Neuroscience, Leibnizing, Diogenes the Cynic, The Experience Machine, Ulf Danielson, The World Itself, Consciousness and the Everything of Physics, Chris Ferry, Where Did the Universe Come From? A book about John Stuart Mill, The Brain in Search of Itself. an internet in your head, how the brain works, the believer encounters with the beginning, the end, and our place in the middle. Frank Wilczek, the Nobel laureate, 10 Keys to Reality, 7.5 Lessons about the Brain, Galileo's Error. And they're all telling me something different. And here am I, having interviewed all of them and asking them all about solipsism. And I asked Frank Wilczek, I said to him, hey, why is one not a prime number? Because it used to be. And he goes, best answer ever. He goes, it wouldn't be convenient.
That is awesome. Wow, you've interviewed some great minds, some incredible thinkers. Yeah. You have some great questions, Sam. Why isn't one a prime? Is that right? So we changed the definition, did we?
Yeah, but back in the early 1900s or a little bit before. Right. Because, and this goes to the very heart of what you talk about and how people interpret it. One is divisible by one, but it's also divisible by itself. So the question is, one is just what we call it. Itself is what it is. But unfortunately, that would make everything prime. And so that's why he said it wouldn't be convenient. So that goes back to your maths. Oh, yeah, because you don't trash math, but you don't include it in your story, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I suppose, I mean, we're always at a particular, I always find human beings always think they're at the end of history. And, part of the story I tell in this book is that I mean, a lot of the evidence for this cosmic purpose is this, the so-called fine tuning of physics for life, that certain numbers in physics are just right for life against improbable odds. And I think we're in a little bit in denial about this as a society at the moment. I think it's maybe a little bit like in the 16th century when we first started getting evidence that we're not in the center of the universe. So people couldn't accept that because it didn't fit with the picture of reality they'd got so used to for thousands of years. And nowadays, people sort of scoff at them and they are those stupid religious people. Why didn't they just follow the new evidence and accept it? But I think every generation absorbs a worldview it can't see beyond. I think for over 100 years after Darwin, science looked like it had made God or anything godish redundant. It looked like this meaningless, purposeless universe. And then we got in that cultural mindset like, okay, we're at the end of history now. We've discovered science has ruled out meaning and purpose beyond what humans make. That's it. And then I think from the 70s onwards, the evidence starts to change. We start to get this fine tuning in physics for life, these numbers that are just right for life. But I think the culture can't keep it. It takes time for the culture to catch up with where the evidence is. I quote the economist Keynes from the early mid 20th century, and a journalist once said to him, you didn't used to think that. And he said, well, when the facts change, I change my mind. What do you do, sir? But I think that's so difficult for human beings to do, to just think, oh, especially, you know, when whether you're religious or whether you're a atheist, you know, that gets into your identity and your sense of who you are. And so that's part of what I'm saying, that like there's certain things that maybe we're not seeing clearly because we're seeing it with certain cultural biases. And
When I first began, I told you I'll jump around, but I always get back to the book, and because you mentioned fine tuning and what people call Goldilocks zone. And I've always thought about the fine tuning, that it's like the anthropic principle. We wouldn't be able to have this discussion if the conditions weren't exactly right for us to be aware of our own existence. But then you think about it and you go, well, maybe the universe only fine tuned us enough to have the very tiny consciousness we have. And if that's the case, that opens up all kinds of doors, like Huxley's doors. Yeah, the doors of perception.
Cool. So yeah, I mean, this is a common response people give. Well, if it wasn't fine-tuned for life, we wouldn't be here, so we wouldn't be thinking about it, so we shouldn't be surprised. I always like to give the the response to that by the philosopher John Leslie, who had a wonderful, one of the earliest books on fine-tuning in the 80s called Universes. He's a very, very interesting figure. Again, he's one of these figures, like what I'm trying to do in this book, sort of between traditional religion and traditional atheism. Anyway, but he gave this firing squad analogy. So suppose you're going to be executed and there's 25 marksmen at close range all aiming at you and they all miss. They load up again and they all miss and they keep missing time and time again. Now, what are you going to think? You're going to think, that's weird that all these expert marksmen keep missing me. This needs explaining. Maybe it's a fake execution like Dostoevsky had. Maybe it's some kind of trick. Maybe I'm dreaming. Now, but if that response to fine-tuning was correct, then you could think, well, if they had hit me, I wouldn't be around to think about it, so I shouldn't be surprised. This doesn't need explaining. But nobody would think that. You'd think, like, it's too improbable. It's, of course, true that if they'd hit me, I wouldn't be around to think about it. Nonetheless, it's true improbable that all these expert marksmen would just happen to miss. So this needs explaining. Likewise, yeah,
going back to your book, it goes to the multiverse. There are an infinite number of universes in which he died. I buy a lottery ticket and I know I'm going to win and I do win. So, well, I knew I was going to win and I did. But there's 6 million different universes in which I didn't win. So what? But you make the multiverse. You take short shrift with the multiverse as well.
No, but it's a very important objection. And look, that's what I used to think for a long, long time. I've always thought the fine tuning needed explaining, but I used to think the multiverse looked like the more plausible way of explaining it. These ideas of cosmic purpose sound as weird to me as anyone, you know. But I was just persuaded over a long period of time by philosophers of probability, experts in the nature of probability, that there's just some dodgy reasoning going on here in this inference from fine-tuning to a multiverse. So it's a big debate here that I go into on the book. Well, I should say, actually, people might be interested. So my first book, which is here, Consciousness and Fundamental Reality, just come out in paperback, actually, by the same month as my new book. That's an academic book that's maybe not very accessible if you don't have a PhD in philosophy. And then Galileo's Error, that's the US version, that's the UK version. That was aimed at general audience. So this book is trying to do both. So each chapter has a more accessible bit and then a digging deeper bit, which tries to get into more technical details, which you can go into if you want or leave if you don't fancy. Anyway, back to the multiverse. Yes, yeah, so here's the basic problem with the multiverse. So suppose, Sam, you and I go to a casino tonight, and when we walk in, into a small room and there's just one person who's having this incredible run of luck. They're just winning again and again and again and again. And I turn to you and I say, wow, there must be lots of people in the casino tonight. And you say, what? What are you talking about, Philip? You know, we just seen this one guy. What's that got to do with elsewhere in the casino? And I say, well, if there are tens of thousands of people playing roulette in the casino, then it's not so surprising that someone's going to have an incredible run of luck. And that's just what we've observed, someone having an incredible run of luck. Now, everyone agrees that's a fallacy. That's the inverse gambler's fallacy. It's related to the more general gambler's fallacy, like when you think, oh, I've had bad luck all night, I'm bound to have good luck this time. That's a fallacy because, you know, your odds of winning at dice or cards or whatever each time are the same. Doesn't matter how long you've been playing or not playing. Right, so everyone agrees the casino example I just gave is a fallacy because our observational evidence is just this one particular person has had an incredible run of luck. No matter how many people there are elsewhere in the casino, if there's a lot or if there's a few, it has no bearing on how likely it is that this one person we've observed plays well. Now, everyone agrees that's a fallacy, but it looks exactly like the reasoning of the multiverse theorists. They look around us and think, wow, the numbers in our physics are just right for life. How improbable. There must be lots of other universes out there with really bad numbers. It's exactly the same reasoning, right? All we've observed is our universe. no matter how many other universes there are out there or are not, it doesn't have any bearing on how likely it is that our universe, the only one we've observed, is fine-tuned. So it's just like explaining the run of luck of this one person in terms of there being other people in the casino.
I was going to say, since you brought up taxes in your book, I'll bring up, I've interviewed financial advisors. And one of the things they call the gambler's prayer is that, you know, you go to the racetrack and, you know, you're betting on 8-5, 2-1, and you don't win all day. And so you're down $10,000 or pounds. And then the last race, you go, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to bet on a 50-1 shot. That way I'll be back. Your prayer is, I just want to get back to where I was. And so something you would never do, which was totally irrational the moment you get to the racetrack, it seems like the best thing to do at the end of the day.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, there are all these errors in probabilistic reasoning you make all the time. One of the best books I've read, actually, already mentioned Dostoevsky by chance, but his book, The Gambler, because he was a gambling addict himself and, you know, lost all his money. He's a very, very impractical person. I'm sure you probably know this stuff. And, you know, The Gambler, if you've read it, is just a short story that so vividly got across the addiction of gambling. He was addicted to gambling himself, of winning and winning and winning and winning, and then slowly, slowly losing. And I very vividly got it across to me. So there are these errors we make. And look, I've just been persuaded that a lot of theoretical physicists are just making some basic probabilistic errors in this whole setup of the multiverse.
They are.
One thing I'm excited about this book, this idea doesn't originate with me, although I think I'm the first person to connect it to the science, incredibly enough, this particular objection to the multiverse. No one in the literature connected it to the actual scientific discussion of the multiverse, strangely enough. But also, in a typical case of academics talking to themselves, this has been in the literature, in the complicated journals since the 80s. Nobody knows about it. Nobody knows about it outside of academic philosophy. So I'm quite excited. Just, you know, like, there's huge interest in this among religious people using it to argue for God, the fine-tuning, or atheists using it to argue for a multiverse. So I'm quite excited to get this out to a broader audience. Although you don't have to go into that if that's in the digging deeper bit of the chapter, if you'd rather steer clear of it.
What about a real phenomenon that belies the idea of a unified consciousness that exists for all of us? Like, you know, that gold dress phenomenon, the gold dress that,
yeah.
So you have people that look at it, and I argued with people that, you know, this is gold. No, this is black. This is blue. And which one is right? It just depends on a semi-solipsistic viewpoint that you have. This is what it is. I believe it 100%. There's no way you can convince me because my senses tell me the dress is this color. What about that?
Yeah, it's a fascinating case, isn't it? And the diversity of perception. And well, I mean, I'm very much spend a lot of time on the science of consciousness, and the diversity actually is between in color perception between different sexes, between different races, between different age groups. There's a huge diversity in color perception. One of the things I explore in the final chapter on the topic of thinking about spiritual practice and what spirituality means. This is an extract that's actually going to be printed in the Wall Street Journal this weekend.
Oh,
hopefully,
really?
If all goes according to plan. It's been delayed a couple of weeks with more significant news events, understandably. But the plan is for this weekend of the way in which our perception is so deeply conditioned by both by the way our brain is hardwired, but also by the way we've learned to experience the world. You know, you look around you, it looks like you're just seeing the world as it is in itself. But of course, in all sorts of ways, you're projecting your very specific cultural understanding onto the world. I mean, you can see this in the way, you know, my voice now, you're not just hearing phonemes, you're hearing meaningful words. And it sounds as if those words, those sounds you're hearing have intrinsic meaning. Of course, that's not actually in the vibrations in the air. You're projecting that onto the sound. And then building on this, so I have this idea of great art or spiritual practice that it's about slowly tearing apart, peeling apart might be better rather than tearing, sounds a bit violent, peeling apart those layers of conditioning to kind of reveal the emptiness within. And that this is a kind of middle way. I'm always up for the middle way, so I'm always going for the middle way. So you can think of this as a middle way between two forms of bad art. So one form of bad art is very dull, banal, boring art or music or literature, where they just follow in a very boring way the cultural way of understanding things, you know, the cultural patterns. Or you might think the extreme racist who just sees every racial group into the terms of the crude caricature of that racial group. The other extreme is like punk, which just kind of tears up the rule book. It's all bollocks, you know, it's all rubbish. I mean, I love the original punk bands, but they're a little bit before my time, but I love them anyway. But the problem is it's not sustainable. Very quickly, punk, that's supposed to be about tearing up the rule book, becomes its own fashion and its own cultural way of seeing the world. So I think the true art takes, works with the cultural forms in which we project onto the world, because we can't really do anything else, but slowly undoes them from within and reveals the emptiness within them. Maybe the Beatles, I'm from Liverpool, you know, the greatest band of all time, the Beatles. They started with ordinary vanilla rock and roll, but then they did new unexpected things with it and took that form into new ways.
In 7 years, from 63 to 70.
It's unbelievable, isn't it?
It's funny because every once in a while, your voice reminds me of George Harrison's. And then also what you're saying reminds me of what George Harrison might say as well.
Yeah, I mean, the Liverpool accent's got much stronger. You know, people from Liverpool fucking speak like this now, mate. For you last night. You are kids, all right, like last night. Told you where to go, right? And people from Liverpool don't actually believe I'm from Liverpool. But if you listen to the Beatles, they had a softer accent. My theory is it's sort of political neglect in the 80s made the accent stronger and rougher.
But you're completely, I'm the one that said I was going to stray from the book. Now you are completely straying from the book. You're doing Liverpudlian accent. And the very beginning of this answer you gave, right, I thought it was about panpsychism. So I'm bringing you back to the book. And so what I said at the beginning is, okay, you say that a snail has some small, tiny part of consciousness that makes it do what a snail does. And then you even go to the idea of a particle. A particle is a particle and does what it does because that's what it was designed to do. And that is its purpose. And lots of people disagree with that. Does a rock have consciousness?
Yeah, so I guess I've made most of my career, I guess my name's been made on defending this crazy, wacky sounding view, panpsychism, the consciousness goes all the way down to the fundamental building blocks of reality. They're not only snails, but fundamental particles such as electrons and quarks have incredibly simple forms of experience, and that the very complex experience of the human or animal brain is somehow built up from these rudimentary forms of consciousness at the fundamental level of physics. So this view was, well, actually, I mean, this view has a rich history going back all the way to the start of philosophy in both West and East. Many of the great Enlightenment figures, Enlightenment philosophers like Leibniz or Spinoza were panpsychists. It was at its heyday in the 19th century. I suppose it's only in the 20th century it sort of fell out of favor. It was laughed at insofar as it was thought of at all. But in the last decade or 15 years, with the work of me and many others, it's really become a view that's taken very seriously in academic philosophy, even some areas of neuroscience. Just as, I suppose, as more conventional approaches to consciousness have just gone nowhere frankly, people are starting to think we need more radical approaches to consciousness. We've got people like my co-host on my podcast or YouTube channel, Mind Chat. I do it with a guy who thinks consciousness doesn't exist.
Right.
Sorry, Keith Frankish, I think consciousness is everywhere. He thinks it's nowhere. So I guess we both think you can't explain consciousness in conventional scientific terms. You know, my story in Galileo's Error is this begins with Galileo getting mathematical physics going by taking consciousness outside of the story of science. So we both agree you can't explain consciousness in conventional scientific terms. I go one way with that and think, well, we need to rethink science. We need to rethink this picture of science that Galileo bequeathed us. Whereas Keith goes the other way and says, well, that means it's nonsense. It doesn't exist. It's like magic or fairy dust or something. But yeah, well, I think
Well, that's the thing about when I tediously listed the people whose books I read, and even when you go back to Leibniz, I talked about, and Diogenes. But the thing about it is, all you guys and women, you have, in my opinion, you tell me why I'm wrong, you have no evidence to support anything that you say. None.
Yeah, give it to me straight. Well, it depends what you mean by evidence. I mean, so one thing I try to argue, people think consciousness is just a scientific problem, but at the core of it is this philosophical difficulty, which has traditionally been called the mind-body problem. We know consciousness exists. How do we know it exists? Just because we're conscious. We're immediately aware of our feelings and experiences. If you're in pain, you're just directly aware of it. We know the physical world exists. Well, maybe solipsists like you don't, but put that on one side just for a second. We know the physical.
You don't know it.
Okay, that's true.
If you say you know it, that means you're my master. Because if I don't know it, then you're telling me that I know it.
Give it to me for the sake of discussion for a second. At least we can take the leap of faith and think, okay, our senses are telling us this about this physical world. And then the challenge is, the philosophical challenge is, how do these things fit together? Consciousness that we know about from the inside and the physical world that we know about through senses. And there are a few different options. Maybe the physical world is the fundamental thing and consciousness comes from processes in the brain. That's the materialist view. That's the kind of what most people think have come to think is common sense in this recent period of history, although not throughout the history of Western or Eastern philosophy. The panpsychist turns that on its head and says, no, it's consciousness that's fundamental. And the physical world arises from underlying facts about mind or consciousness. Okay, so we've got these two different options, these two different explanatory projects. And one way we can, so you say I've got no evidence. Well, I mean, it's not going to be an experiment in that sense. There's no experiment you can do that can prove it, because any experiment, each of these views will just interpret the data in their own terms. So that's why it's not really a scientific question. But we can ask, well, how well have each of these projects done in terms of their explanatory aspirations? So the materialist tries to explain the emergence of consciousness in terms of physical processes in the brain. How well have they done at that? Well, despite decades of a lot of effort and time going into this, it's got precisely nowhere. It's not just that we don't have the full story. We haven't managed to explain a single conscious experience in terms of underlying neural activity.
Okay. Well,
but then the panpsychist project, and you probably want to come back on this, but I would say we've already solved the mysteries. We know how to make sense of the physical world arising from underlying facts about mind and consciousness. We know how to make sense of that. The mystery solved. So we've got these two explanatory projects, one of which has never gone anywhere, the other of which we've already worked out how to do. We've already solved the mysteries. So to my mind, it's clear which is more plausible. You can never prove it for certain, but I think the panpsychist approach, it feels weird culturally, but it's more plausible because it's just been more explanatorily successful.
I'm sure you want
to push back on that.
But, I will not. This is the last time I will use the S word, solipsistic, because it gets everybody I talk to irritated. So I'm not doing it anymore. But you do talk about the Turing test. And in the old days when Turing suggested it, there's no way that you could have lasted 20 minutes. And now I can talk to ChatGPT for an hour. And there's so many more things that are advanced that we don't even know about, where because of the way we interact now, not in person like we aren't, and that you could do a doppelganger of you, but I can be fooled for hours. And so you say in the book, well, they're not conscious. And I would go, well, maybe they are conscious. I don't know. But that experiment has changed. He said that human, if they fool you for 20 minutes, there's no difference between them and you.
Yeah. I mean, well, when I wrote Galileo's Error, I said, you know, there's always this media hype that things have passed the Turing test, but they never have. But I'm not sure ChatGPT has officially passed the Turing test, but I mean, clearly we are very, very close. It's absolutely extraordinary what this system can do, these large language models. And the implications for consciousness are very unclear. And I have a piece in Scientific American that came out last week in a related topic. So I have a very non-reductionist view of consciousness. This is what I go into in the book. So although I'm a panpsychist, I have this kind of view that consciousness comes in layers. So there's consciousness at the level of particles or fields, there's consciousness at the level of molecules, cells, large parts of the brain, these layers of consciousness, and each of them comes with new dynamics, new forms of behavior. So I think if something were conscious, in principle, we could see that conscious systems have these new dynamics that aren't entirely reducible to underlying chemistry and physics. Whereas ChatGPT, it's a bit tricky because these things have got so complicated, we no longer know how they work. The people who made them no longer know how they work. They trained them rather than, you know, explicitly programmed every little bit detail. But I think we know enough about how they work that we know that everything they're doing is in principle reducible to underlying chemistry and physics. I mean, I was at a tech event recently with one of the people who made ChatGPT working for OpenAI, and I was confirmed in this viewpoint. So that's why I think they're not conscious, because I think systems that are conscious would display a certain kind of autonomy, a certain kind of partial independence from the laws of physics, that not breaking the laws of physics, but new causal principles will arise in conscious systems that supplement the basic equation of physics. I mean, I argue for this on the basis of the need to make sense of the evolution of consciousness. But so that's my argument as to why ChatGPT is not conscious. But, you know, it's a very, very thorny issue.
You want to hear what I think the purpose of the universe is?
I would love to. Go for it.
So I feel that the universe is tending towards good. So it's just moving toward good. And we are we're always in the middle. You like the middle way. So if the universe is infinite, we're always in the middle, no matter where we are. And we're just this tiny, tiny, tiny infinitesimal part of the universe. But the universe is tending towards good. So our part is to tend towards good as well. So if we're not to change anything, but we're still tending in the right direction, no matter how small we are. So if you tend in the right direction, you go with the universe. But if you're, and I won't name names currently, if you're a certain person and you're tending not towards the good, then you're left behind, which is essentially hell, because you'll be alone in solitude in an empty room with no stimulus forever and forever and forever. That's my theory. I just don't want to get stuck on the wrong side.
I like it. That was very beautifully put. I mean, it's not too dissimilar, I think, to what I'm defending in the book. I mean, to my mind, I think the universe as we find it is a mix of accident and design, a heady cocktail of the two. You know, so some things I think are so finely tuned that they suggest a kind of purpose or goal directedness, like the fine tuning, certain things to do with the evolution of consciousness. But then some things seem so arbitrary and terrible and pointless. You're talking about the terrible suffering in Gaza at the moment and so on, and the horrific things we find in the natural world and the immensity. There's so much of the universe is empty nothingness, although it's very beautiful. So I think we need a theory that can account for both of these. I think atheists can't account for the fine-tuningness. Traditional religious believers can't account for the gratuitous suffering and the arbitrariness. We need a theory that can account for both. But I think somewhere in the mix, yes, I think there is a push towards the good. And I mean, you could take the attitude, I don't care about it. It's I'm going to live my own life. But, you know, if we can connect up to a broader ethical project that encompasses not just humanity, not just sentient life on this earth, but an ethical project that envelops the whole of reality for a good purpose. Wow, how meaningful could one's life be apart from contributing to such a huge project? You know, I think we want our lives to make a difference.
But if you say
that's pretty massive.
If you say it's theoretical, like say 1905, Einstein has a thought experiment and he proposes a certain theory, and then you wait 50 years or Arthur Eddington goes and looks at the eclipse and it becomes experimentally verified. What you guys all do is nothing that you posit can ever be, at least in my opinion, verified experimentally, empirically.
Yeah, and the person who verified Einstein's theory I talk about in Galileo's Era was a panpsychist who developed some of these early panpsychist ideas, Arthur Eddington. It was, and he made Einstein an overnight celebrity with this English scientist confirming this Swiss-German scientist's theory of gravity that overturned Newton's theory of gravity. Anyway, that's a digression. That's nothing.
And then someone asked him, is it true there's only two people that understand Einstein's theory in the world? And he goes, who's the other one?
Yeah. So he was, was it because he was, he didn't fight in the war for some reason? Was he doing some scientific research in the First World War?
Yeah.
So he was reading Einstein's very complicated theory of general relativity, is Einstein's theory of gravity, one of the first to read it. And it's very complicated mathematics that even Einstein himself struggled with. It took him 10 years. And so it was seen as a wonderful moment of post-war reconciliation, actually, that this English scientist confirmed this Swiss-German theory, which overturned Newton. Anyway, but I've forgotten the question now. I wanted to answer the question.
You can't prove what you're saying.
Oh yeah, it's a good question. So a lot of people, I found one very common reaction to fine tuning. The wonderful scientist Roger Penrose, Nobel Prize winner, which I was lucky enough to have one-to-one lunch with couple of years ago by chance at a conference. You know, wonderful creative thinker, very undogmatic in lots of ways. But his response to fine tuning is, oh, well, it's probably going to change. The evidence will change. You know, physics isn't complete yet. We haven't worked out how to make our best theory of big things, namely Einstein's general relativity, fit with our best theory of little things, namely quantum mechanics. Maybe when we get those two together, all this fine tuning business will go away. Well, that's possible. It's equally possible when we get this final theory, there'll be more fine tuning in it. You know, all we can ever do. And so I think it's like, it's very common that people with fine tuning ramp up the standards of evidence in ways you don't do anywhere else. Like it's, oh, we can only draw conclusions when we've completed physics. You know, it's like, you know, but all we can ever do is work with the evidence we currently have. And you're right, it could all end tomorrow. And okay, then the evidence for cosmic purpose might go away. But we've got it today, and that's all we can ever do. And so that in terms of like the philosophical scientific case, you've just got to go with the evidence you currently have. But then there's the question of, okay, well, my own existential commitments, like what am I going to live my life by? And there, I think it's perfectly reasonable to say, well, I'm going to commit to this. I'm going to take a leap of faith, a leap of hope, and I'm going to live in hope of cosmic purpose, see the good I'm doing is connecting to some greater reality, because that gives me motivation, that gives me a sense of meaning. And we're not here very long. It makes me happier. And I have personally found it. I don't want to be dogmatic about the only good way of living a life, but I found it to be a meaningful way of living a life. And so, yeah. And then if the evidence changed, you can say, well, all right, well, it's too late for me. I've made this commitment. Maybe it's wrong. But so I think we've got to distinguish those, the theoretical questions from the sort of life commitments as finite creatures. You've got to sort of put your flag in the sand somewhere, and that's fine. That's
I'm so envious of you meeting Roger Penrose. But of course, this is the guy who wrote a book, The Road to Reality, a complete guide to the laws of the universe.
I never got all the way through that, but yeah, he's
right.
Wonderful.
Try periodic tiling of the plane is even harder.
Oh really?
Yeah. I can look at my bathroom floor and I can see it's a periodic tiling of the plane, but that's as far as I can get.
Yeah, he has this idea of the three realms: the physical world, the mental world, and the mathematical world. The world of that mathematicians penetrate, of maths and logic, and all of these three worlds connect up in hard to explain ways. And yeah, I think he was onto something there, a real deep mystery. He's wonderful.
Did you really have lunch with him?
Yeah, it was at there's two big consciousness conferences, one in Tucson, Arizona, every other year, called Science of Consciousness. And yeah, we were just there in the lunch queue together. And well, because the organizer of the Tucson conference is his collaborator on consciousness, Stuart Hameroff. So I know Stuart, and I said, oh, hi. And, you know, wanted to sort of chat to Roger. And then so we ended up sitting down and Stuart went off to do something else. So I had lunch with Roger Penrose. Oh, my God.
That's great.
I talked to him about fine tuning and the inverse gambler's fallacy objection. He thought that was interesting. And yeah, I struggled to keep up with the physics he was talking to me about.
That reminds me, you got some really good blurbs for your book. I mean, those and the blurbs were so good that they kind of explained the book to a certain extent in themselves. That was great. There's like there's more than five or six, actually. How come you didn't get David Chalmers to blurb it?
He said to me, this is a cosmic teleology is a little bit out of his area of expertise. So yeah, when you blurred my last book, my last two books, and he's been, you know, a huge mentor throughout my life and a huge support. And Chalmers always, I worked at his postdoc. If people don't know what a postdoc is, if you finish your PhD, if you're lucky enough, you'll get a year or two doing a job where you can just do some writing. So I was doing that in his center for consciousness. And he used to do this thing. I'd be working on a paper for months and then he'd just destroy it with an objection in 10 seconds.
That's great. That's how you learn.
And, you know, those moments you can go two ways. You can think, I give up. It's all rubbish. Or you can think, no, I'm going to go on. And, you know, those defining moments. So he was always brutal in a nice way, not nasty, but he was always very cut straight to the devastating objection. But I've been very lucky.
The guys who are really at the top of their game all started by working with Douglas Hofstadter. And
yes,
that's amazing to me because he was like my hero. When I read Gerl Escher Bach, it was like, holy, this is amazing. And it's funny how it all goes back to him, but then you don't hear about him that much anymore.
Yeah, what was this tech event I was at in Sweden, the organizers had invited him and he wrote this very amusing letter back about why he's not coming, because why he doesn't do conferences anymore, because I can't remember now. I wish I remembered. It was a very amusing letter. It's all pointless or something. Anyway, and it was read out at dinner.
But
most of this conference was sort of tech leaders and so on, you know, the president of Spotify. I can't remember who it was that. But anyway, they had a kind of novelty panel on the philosophy of consciousness, you know, that I was on. It's the only time I've gone onto stage to flashing lights at this tech. But many people, many of these sort of tech leaders have been inspired by Douglas Hofstadter as well. So yeah, huge influence. And with a popular book, you know, philosophers don't do this enough. Try to reach out to a broader audience. They just talk to themselves. And
I would never use this word, but since you used it in the book, you said at one point, you said masturbatory. You actually said that.
Did I? I remember that.
And it was like, okay, I kind of see what he's saying in that you are I'm in a strange loop, as Hofstadter would say, but you're in a closed loop for the most part. As you say, you're not getting to me. You're at these conferences, you fly in, you have your meal, you talk to people that you really admire and love, and they agree or disagree with you. And then what's the point?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think there's a role for that as well. And you want to sort of, you know, it's great in academia, you can get really specialized, and it does get jargony when you get really specialized and people who really know the topic. And that, I think that's great, but you've got to connect to a broader audience. And I think part of the challenge is, as philosophers, we're trained to have these sort of watertight arguments. So you're trying to cover all possible objections, and then it just gets very complicated. And this is why it's difficult for me writing popular work, because I have to simplify it. I have to not consider every objection. And then the fear is my colleagues are going to think I'm dumb, you know, because I haven't given a complicated. So that's why, you know, with my last book, I already had the academic book, so I could say, oh, that's the real argument. So it's a bit of a risk with this book. That,
well, you did say you do have your deeper dive. So that kind of gives you
even that bit, maybe, you know, might not satisfy some academics. But look, I just think it's so important to talk to a broader audience and, you know, inspire people who are outside of this arena.
Who's that woman that has that podcast and you disagree with her? I've forgotten her name. It seems like there's an S or a couple of S's in it. She's lovely. I think she may be German, I'm not sure. And she has all these podcasts where she talks about the very things you talk about. You do mention her in the book.
Are you talking about Sabina Hossenfelder?
Yes.
I've never spoken to, we've just been having these last few days, a Twitter argument actually about the nature of science, whether science tells us anything about reality or whether it's all just about predictions. And I think probably this Twitter argument's accidentally been probably the best publicity for the book.
Really?
I don't know. No, maybe that's an exaggeration, but it's going to be getting a lot of attention, this Twitter discussion. And it was connected to an argument, an article I had in, people might be interested in the conversation. It's an online UK magazine we have here for academics to get their work out to a broader audience. And I had something on this objection to the multiverse connected to the book. And anyway, Sabine Hossenfelder.
It's just, so I can look it up. It's just called The Conversation.
Yeah, just called The Conversation. This is called Many Physicists Think We're in a Multiverse. It's Have They Got the Basic Maths Wrong or something. And she tweeted something kind of nothing to do with it, saying, I can't remember exactly what she said now. Well, science doesn't tell us about reality anyway, doesn't. So she has this very, what philosophers call positivist view, that science isn't telling us what's real. It's just telling us it's a tool for prediction. And I was saying, well, that's a controversial view. Do you have an argument for it?
You said that exactly. I remember it's on the right-hand side at the bottom of the page. And you said something about her. It wasn't really a dig at her, but you said it was like one of those things where you go, notwithstanding, she still feels that.
Yeah. So she had a blog post a few years ago critiquing panpsychism, and I think just misunderstanding the view, thinking it's inconsistent with contemporary physics. But she was thinking, she was having this interpretation of panpsychism where we're saying particles have their physical properties like mass and charge and stuff, and also these strange consciousness properties. And then she was thinking, well, if they have these extra consciousness properties, that should show up in our experiments. And it doesn't seem to. But that's not the view, right? The view is that there's this consciousness description is underneath physics. So physics is this is the influence of Eddington. This was Eddington's ideas who confirmed general relativity. That physics is just kind of mathematical structure. And there's a question of what underlies that mathematical structure. So the panpsychist tells a story about some kind of networks of conscious entities that underlie the story of physics. So physics doesn't have to change. Physics can just be it as it is. So yeah, I met her at a conference recently, actually. Well, at this festival we have here called How the Light Gets In, sort of ideas festival. I met her in the green room and I said, very politely, can I talk about your critique of panpsychism? But she said, I've got to work on my YouTube channel. And so.
Where she has one YouTube that kind of, you know what I was thinking too? Well, first of all, my hero, Richard Feynman, there's one Nova episode where he's sitting in a chair and he's talking about how all this stuff is going through us, you know, whether it's gamma rays or whether it's neutrinos, all at the same time that we have no conscious awareness of. And I thought, well, okay, maybe when we die, maybe there is this something that comes out of us and rejoins this universe tending towards good that I talked about earlier. But he also talks about a chess game, you know, aliens come here and they look at chess and they figure it out completely. And they go, oh, we understand everything now, like you said. And then all of a sudden someone castles. And they go, what the hell is that? You know, how did that happen? How did they do that? And that's what Penrose, I guess, was saying. When things change, she'll change his mind.
Yeah. I mean, there's so much that's unknown, isn't there? And I mean, I think physics is,
I want to go to these conferences. Invite me to one of the conferences. I want to irritate people there.
Well, I've got at the moment
one person. I want to irritate a lot of people at the same time. I'll do my solipsism thing.
Yeah, because I've got this. I've got a grant at the moment with the Templeton Foundation. I've got 3 years to try and work out if the universe is conscious, with a guy Andre Bukharev from the States, from Marist College in the States. And we had a conference just in the US a couple of weeks ago, and I debated the physicist Sean Carroll as part of that conference on materialism and panpsychism and which is the more plausible expansionary project.
Do you ever get really mad? Do you get angry at each other?
That got intense. People in the audience, so it was on campus and, you know, lots of students in the audience and I said he wouldn't get a good grade if he took my course because he didn't understand philosophical arguments this particular philosophical, and people but it was good spirited. It was good, you know, it was good spirit. It wasn't nasty. We had a drink afterwards. And I always try to be good. I love engaging with people I disagree with. I mean, my podcast Mind Chat, me and Keith have the total opposite. Trying to get in the mindset, people whose views you just find totally baffling. And, you know, so Sabine Hassenfeld as well, I really disagree with her, but, you know, she's a very interesting thinker. And, you know, it's just great to get ideas out there.
Have you ever read that book, Wittgenstein's Poker?
Oh, yeah, a long time ago. Yeah, yeah. Adrian Edmondson.
That's what I was thinking of. You know, you pick up a metal stick and hit the person that you disagree with, which is an excellent way to win the argument.
Yeah, so what was that? It was a talk by Karl Popper, and Wittgenstein was in the audience and was playing in an agitated, slightly aggressive fashion with this poker, I guess, by the fireside in these gentleman-like club things. And Wittgenstein interrogated him and said, give me an example of a moral statement, a moral proposition. And Popper said, maybe you shouldn't threaten guests with a poker. Wittgenstein, yeah. I mean, I always think Wittgenstein is the most pretentious philosopher that ever lived. A very interesting thinker in lots of ways. But his PhD. I tell my students, you know, you've got to talk about other people's work. It's not just your own ideas. But Wittgenstein's PhD, the Tractatus, was just his own wild thoughts. Didn't talk about anybody else. And Bertrand Russell was his examiner. And he said, look, you need to make some changes. You need to bring in other people. But Wittgenstein said, no, take it as it is. I'm a genius. Take it as it is or I'm out of here. So they gave it to him. But as I say to my students, that doesn't usually work.
Okay. We've got to wind down because you have to be sick of me. But yeah, I was just thinking of Principia Mathematica because it's like, you know, how he said it hurt his brain and then it was all wrong and it takes 200 pages to determine that 2 plus 4. And that always goes in my mind to what you were talking about, because it's just like, here's this guy who's a genius, and yet he made a very crucial error in what he was working on. And I guess it was Kurt Gödel who wrote the letter saying, hey, you screwed up here.
Wasn't it? So I think it was.
Maybe it wasn't.
Frege's. Yeah. So there's Frege's. I'm blanking on it as well now. I think it was, you know, Frege's one key axiom was that every group of objects corresponds to a set. And then Russell raised the objection. Oh, God, I've forgotten it all now.
All right. I can edit it out.
Connected with the set of all things that are not members of themselves.
Correct.
Yeah, I can't bloody, it's too late at night. I can't remember it as well. But it was a single, simple, devastating objection to the whole work. And
it is a theory of incompleteness. So it is Gödel of the line.
Yeah, so Gödel's a different kind of incompleteness. Yeah, Gödel showed that for any I've got ink all over my hands. I'm just playing with the pen. For any set of any kind of algorithm, a set of rules, you're not going to be able to demonstrate all the truths of arithmetic from those axioms, which is, you know, has absolutely huge implication. No, right. I know you are right. Right. I'm thinking of something else. Yes. So no, I see how. So I think there's two. I think we're talking about different devastating objections. So yes. In principle, Russell and Whitehead were trying to reduce mathematics to logic, to try and explain mathematics in terms of logic. Gödel's incompleteness theorem is devastating to that, because he proved that for any set of axioms, you're not going to be able to deduce all the truths of mathematics. And he didn't just state that, he proved it. So it is really devastating, I think, to that attempt to explain mathematics in terms of just logic,
which goes to your rivalry with that woman, because you're saying what's happening is under physics, you know, so she can't explain.
Yeah, I mean, I think this has huge implications and brings us back to Roger Penrose, because Roger Penrose is a Platonist. He thinks that there is this world of mathematics, this timeless, eternal world of mathematical truths that mathematicians somehow penetrate and discover facts about. It's not made up, it's discovered. And this creates all sorts of complexity. Like, how does that world impact our brains and so on? But I think Gödel's incompleteness theorem gives us strong support for Platonism, because yeah, if you could just reduce maths to logic, then you could say, oh, that Platonic world is a load of nonsense. It's just about logic, ultimately. But if you can't, as I think Gödel proved, then there does seem to be this irreducible realm of mathematical truth. There's something else I was going to say, but I've forgotten. So, yeah, I think...
Well, it's like I've always really loved romantically. You can write it down. What I've loved really romantically is this idea of crystalline spheres of this, you know, we could start with Plato's cave, but this idea that there are these real things that they just exist up there, and they're beautiful. They're like timepieces, but only more and more intricately put together, and nothing can take them apart, because they are just, it's like the harmony of the music of the spheres, like that.
Yeah, that's beautiful. Yeah.
It's about beauty. You could write a book about beauty, like Umberto Eco.
Yeah. Whitehead said that all philosophy is just footnotes to Plato. I think Plato had that idea of this timeless, eternal realm of mathematics and also of value. He thought the world of value.
Well, you talk about value in the book.
Yeah, I get a bit autobiographical about my... I was just going to say before I get to that, although Gödel's incompleteness theorem sort of refutes that project of Russell and Whitehead of reducing mathematics to logic. Still, the logic that was developed in that whole project, and Frege as well, is, you know, indispensable for computer science as we find it now. So all these, you know, incredible spin-offs of blue sky thinking, nonsense philosophy, you know, Bayes' theorem that I talk about a lot in the book, the core of the core equation of probabilistic reasoning, so important in tracking the pandemic, in the predictive processing paradigm in neuroscience. That was created by the Reverend Thomas Bayes trying to respond to Hume's argument against miracles. So I love these examples of philosophy going in these strange directions. But yeah, I used to be a subjectivist about ethics, a fan of David Hume, who said reason is the slave of the passions, that all life goals are sort of equally acceptable, rationally speaking. If one person wants to make humanity happier and another wants to torture as many people as possible and another wants to count blades of grass, they're all equal. But I get a bit autobiographical at that point, talk about being persuaded in a pub by a philosophy professor when I was doing my graduate study that Hume's view was actually just kind of self-defeating, and that just blew my mind. And
well, it's self-serving. I mean, we talked about utilitarianism with, you know, it's Hume, Bentham, John Stuart Mill, and they all changed it because Hume was, it was like basically do whatever you want, have as much pleasure as you can. Then each of them down the line tried to make it, no, help your fellow human being more, and then, you know, help your fellow human being. But the woman said, no, Hume doesn't care about helping your fellow human being at all.
Yeah, he famously said, it's no more contrary to reason to prefer the destruction of the world to the scratching of my finger. Or, yeah, but so I do end up believing in objective value. And of course, the view I argue in the book is that not only are there objective Platonic facts about value, but I think there's evidence that they somehow influence and impact the evolution of the physical universe. In these early stages of the universe, things were somehow shaped by facts about value, which sounds weird and bizarre and not what we expected. But I think we've got to put aside our biases, both religious and secular, and just follow the evidence where it leads. And I think the evidence is pointing towards cosmic purpose, like it or not.
Okay, well, you always say you don't know how to end these things. Here's a great way of ending it. So like at the very last chapter, I thought, this is great. He's going to tell me what the purpose of the universe is. I thought, this is great. And then you, at the last chapter, you go, well, what is the purpose of the universe? I don't know.
Well, I say a little bit. I mean, I suppose, look, I do argue that there's reason to think this, that there is this cosmic.
You did Porky Pig. You did That's All, folks.
Yeah, okay. But I think we know where cosmic purpose is directed as looking backwards. I think there is this directedness towards the emergence of life, intelligent life, that's evidenced by the fine tuning and the emergence of creatures with conscious understanding of the world around them. I try to argue that there's reason to think that's part of cosmic purpose. Now, what about the future? As I say, yeah, Porky Pig time. It could be. That's all, folks. It could be, but
that sounded like Liverpool right there.
the great Liverpudlian Porky. So, but once we believe in cosmic purpose, or we take that idea seriously, you get to think it's somewhat improbable that, oh, we happen to be at the very climax, the culmination of the whole of cosmic purpose. So you might think it's more likely that this is still unfolding in ways we don't understand, that there will emerge some greater form of life and consciousness as unfathomable to us as our existence is to ants. So yeah, there's a great deal of uncertainty here. I'll be the first to admit it. The answer is not simply 42, as it said in The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. But I think there's evidence for some kind of push towards the good. Where that will go, who knows? But so this is not a simple dogmatism of traditional religion, but in a way I think that makes it richer, that we're talking of some kind of hope and a greater purpose that's still unfolding that we don't yet fully understand, but we can perhaps find meaning and motivation from.
Our guest today has been Philip Goff, author of Why, The Purpose of the Universe. And Philip, it was a pleasure talking to you. I also feel like I'm your friend, except I'd rather just go out drinking. Can we do that?
That would be wonderful. Where are you based again?
I'm in Philadelphia, just outside of Philadelphia.
Okay, if I'm ever in Philadelphia, we can hook up. You can show me some great bars. I like a beer myself. It's been a wonderful conversation, Sam. Thank you for having me on again to talk about this book. See you next time I have a book out.
Okay. It'll be my pleasure. Thanks so much.
Thank you.